improvement. Within a few days, George Rona got a letter from this man asking Rona to come to see him. Rona went and got a job. George Rona discovered for himself that a soft answer turneth away wrath. We may not be saintly enough to love our enemies, but for the sake of our own health and happiness, let's at least forgive them and forget them. That is the smart thing to do. To be wronged or robbed, said Confucius, is nothing unless you continue to remember it. I once asked General Eisenhower's son John if his father ever nourished resentments. No, he replied, Dad never wastes a minute thinking about people he doesn't like. There's an old saying that a man is a fool who can't be angry, but a man is wise who won't be angry. That was the policy of William J. Gaynor, a former mayor of New York. Bitterly denounced by the press, he was shot by a maniac and almost killed. As he lay in the hospital fighting for his life, he said, "Every night I forgive everything and everybody." Is that too idealistic? Too much sweetness and light? If so, let's turn for counsel to the great German philosopher Schopenhauer, author of Studies in Pessimism. He regarded life as a futile and painful adventure. Gloom dripped from him as he walked, yet out of the depths of his despair, Schopenhauer cried, "If possible, no animosity should be felt for anyone." I once asked Bernard Baruch, the man who was the trusted advisor to six presidents, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, Roosevelt, and Truman, whether he was ever disturbed by the attacks of his enemies. "No man can humiliate me or disturb me," he replied. "I won't let him." No one can humiliate or disturb you and me either, unless we let him. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Throughout the ages, mankind has burned its candles before those Christ-like individuals who bore no malice against their enemies. I have often stood in the Jasper National Park in Canada and gazed upon one of the most beautiful mountains in the Western world, a mountain named in honor of Edith Cavell, the British nurse who went to her death like a saint before a German firing squad on October 12, 1915. Her crime? She had hidden and fed and nursed wounded French and English soldiers in her Belgian home, and had helped them escape into Holland. As the English chaplain entered her cell in the military prison in Brussels that October morning to prepare her for death, Edith Cavell uttered two sentences that have been preserved in bronze and granite. "I realize that patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness toward anyone." 4 years later, her body was removed to England, and memorial services were held in Westminster Abbey. I once spent a year in London. I have often stood before the statue of Edith Cavell opposite the National Portrait Gallery and read her immortal words carved in granite. "I realize that patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness toward anyone." One sure way to forgive and forget our enemies is to become absorbed in some cause infinitely bigger than ourselves. Then the insults and the enmities we encounter won't matter, because we will be oblivious of everything but our cause. As an example, let's take an intensely dramatic event that was about to take place in the pine woods of Mississippi back in 1918, a lynching. Lawrence Jones, a black teacher and preacher, was about to be lynched. Some years ago, I visited the school that Lawrence Jones founded, the Piney Woods Country School, and I spoke before the student body. That school is nationally known today, but the incident I'm going to relate occurred long before that. It occurred back in the highly emotional days of the First World War. A rumor had spread through central Mississippi that the Germans were arousing the blacks and inciting them to rebellion. Lawrence Jones, the man who was about to be lynched, was, as I have already said, a black himself and was accused of helping to arouse his race to insurrection. A group of white men, pausing outside the church, had heard Lawrence Jones shouting to his congregation, "Life is a battle in which every black must gird on his armor and fight to survive and succeed." Fight! Armor! Enough! Galloping off into the night, these excited young men recruited a mob, returned to the church, put a rope around the preacher, dragged him for a mile up the road, stood him on a heap of kindling lighted matches, and were about to hang him and burn him at the same time when someone shouted, "Let's make the blankety-blank-blank talk before he burns. Speech! Speech!" Lawrence Jones, standing on the kindling, spoke with a rope around his neck, spoke for his life and his cause. He had been graduated from the University of Iowa in 1907. His sterling character, his scholarship, and his musical ability had made him popular with both the students and the faculty. Upon graduation, he had turned down the offer of a hotel man to set him up in business, and had turned down the offer of a wealthy man to finance his musical education. Why? Because he was on fire with a vision. Reading the story of Booker T. Washington's life, he'd been inspired to devote his own life to educating the poverty-stricken, illiterate members of his race. So he went to the most backward belt he could find in the South, a spot 25 miles south of Jackson, Mississippi. Pawning his watch for $1.65, he started his school in the open woods with a stump for a desk. Lawrence Jones told these angry men who were waiting to lynch him of the struggle he had had to educate these unschooled boys and girls and to train them to be good farmers, mechanics, cooks, housekeepers. He told of the white men who had helped him in his struggle to establish Piney Woods Country School, white men who had given him land, lumber, and pigs, cows, and money to help him carry on his educational work. When Lawrence Jones talked with sincere and moving eloquence, as he pleaded not for himself but his cause, the mob began to soften. Finally, an old Confederate veteran in the crowd said, "I believe this boy is telling the truth. I know the white men whose names he has mentioned. He is doing fine work. We have made a mistake. We ought to help him instead of hang him." The Confederate veteran passed his hat through the crowd and raised a gift of $52.40 from the very men who had gathered there to hang the founder of the Piney Woods Country School, the man who said, "I have no time to quarrel, no time for regrets, and no man can force me to stoop low enough to hate him." Epictetus pointed out 19 centuries ago that we reap what we sow, and that somehow fate almost always makes us pay for our malefactions. "In the long run," said Epictetus, "every man will pay the penalty for his own misdeeds. The man who remembers this will be angry with no one, indignant with no one, revile no one, blame no one, offend no one, hate no one." Probably no other man in American history was ever more denounced and hated and double-crossed than Lincoln. Yet Lincoln, according to Herndon's classic biography, never judged men by his like or dislike for them. If any given act was to be performed, he could understand that his enemy could do it just as well as anyone. If a man had maligned him or had been guilty of personal ill-treatment and was the fittest man for the place, Lincoln would give him that place just as soon as he would give it to a friend. I do not think he ever removed a man because he was his enemy or because he disliked him. Lincoln was denounced and insulted by some of the very men he had appointed to positions of high power, men like McClellan, Seward, Stanton, and Chase. Yet Lincoln believed, according to Herndon, his law partner, that no man was to be eulogized for what he did or censured for what he did or did not do, because all of us are the children of conditions, of circumstances, of environment, of education, of acquired habits, and of heredity, molding men as they are and will forever be. Perhaps Lincoln was right. If you and I had inherited the same physical, mental, and emotional characteristics that our enemies have inherited, and if life had done to us what it has done to them, we would act exactly as they do. We couldn't possibly do anything else. Let's be charitable enough to repeat the prayer of the Sioux Indians. "O Great Spirit, keep me from ever judging and criticizing a man until I have walked in his moccasins for 2 weeks." So instead of hating our enemies, let's pity them and thank God that life has not made us what they are. Instead of heaping condemnation and revenge upon our enemies, let us give them our understanding, our sympathy, our help, our forgiveness, and our prayers. I was brought up in a family which read the scriptures or repeated a verse from the Bible each night, and then knelt down and said family prayers. I can still hear my father, in a lonely Missouri farmhouse, repeating these words of Jesus, words that will continue to be repeated as long as man cherishes his ideals. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. My father tried to live those words of Jesus, and they gave him an inner peace that the captains and the kings of earth have often sought for in vain. To cultivate a mental attitude that will bring you peace and happiness, remember that rule two is, let's never try to get even with our enemies, because if we do, we will hurt ourselves far more than we hurt them. Let's do as General Eisenhower does. Let's never waste a minute thinking about people we don't like. Chapter 14. If you do this, you will never worry about ingratitude. I recently met a businessman in Texas who was burned up with indignation. I was warned that he would tell me about it within 15 minutes after I met him. He did. The incident he was angry about had occurred 11 months previously, but he was still burned up about it. He couldn't talk of anything else. He had given his 34 employees $10,000 in Christmas bonuses, approximately $300 each, and no one had thanked him. "I am sorry," he complained bitterly, "that I ever gave them a penny." "An angry man," said Confucius, "is always full of poison." This man was so full of poison that I honestly pitied him. He was about 60 years old. Now, life insurance companies figure that, on the average, we will live slightly more than two-thirds of the difference between our present age and 80. So this man, if he was lucky, probably had about 14 or 15 years to live. Yet he had already wasted almost one of his few remaining years by his bitterness and resentment over an event that was past and gone. I pitied him. Instead of wallowing in resentment and self-pity, he might have asked himself why he didn't get any appreciation. Maybe he'd underpaid and overworked his employees. Maybe they considered a Christmas bonus not a gift, but something they had earned. Maybe he was so critical and unapproachable that no one dared or cared to thank him. Maybe they felt he gave the bonus because most of the profits were going for taxes anyway. On the other hand, maybe the employees were selfish, mean, and ill-mannered. Maybe this, maybe that. I don't know any more about it than you do. But I do know that Dr. Samuel Johnson said, "Gratitude is a fruit of great cultivation. You do not find it among gross people." Now, here's the point I'm trying to make. This man made the human and distressing mistake of expecting gratitude. He just didn't know human nature. If you saved a man's life, would you expect him to be grateful? You might, but Samuel Leibowitz, who was a famous criminal lawyer before he became a judge, saved 78 men from going to the electric chair. How many of these men do you suppose stopped to thank Samuel Leibowitz or ever took the trouble to send him a Christmas card? How many? Guess. That's right. None. Christ helped 10 lepers in one afternoon, but how many of these lepers ever stopped to thank him? Only one. Look it up in St. Luke. When Christ turned around to his disciples and asked, "Where are the other nine?" they had all run away, disappeared without thanks. Let me ask you a question. Why should you and I, or this businessman in Texas, expect more thanks for our small favors than was given Jesus Christ? And when it comes to money matters, well, that's even more hopeless. Charles Schwab told me that he once saved a bank cashier who had speculated in the stock market with funds belonging to the bank. Schwab put up the money to save this man from going to the penitentiary. Was the cashier grateful? Oh, yes, for a little while. Then he turned against Schwab and reviled him and denounced him, the very man who kept him out of jail. If you gave one of your relatives $1 million, would you expect him to be grateful? Andrew Carnegie did just that. But if Andrew Carnegie had come back from the grave a little while later, he would have been shocked to find this relative cursing him. Why? Because old Andy had left $365 million to public charities and had cut him off with one measly million, as he put it. That's how it goes. Human nature has always been human nature, and it probably won't change in your lifetime, so why not accept it? Why not be as realistic about it as was old Marcus Aurelius, one of the wisest men who ever ruled the Roman Empire? He wrote in his diary one day, "I am going to meet people today who talk too much, people who are selfish, egotistical, ungrateful, but I won't be surprised or disturbed, for I couldn't imagine a world without such people." That makes sense, doesn't it? If you and I go around grumbling about ingratitude, who is to blame? Is it human nature, or is it our ignorance of human nature? Let's not expect gratitude. Then, if we get some occasionally, it will come as a delightful surprise. If we don't get it, we won't be disturbed. Now, here's the first point I'm trying to make in this chapter. It is natural for people to forget to be grateful. So if we go around expecting gratitude, we're heading straight for a lot of headaches. I know a woman in New York who's always complaining because she's lonely. Not one of her relatives wants to go near her, and no wonder. If you visit her, she'll tell you for hours what she did for her nieces when they were children. She nursed them through the measles and the mumps and the whooping cough. She boarded them for years. She helped to send one of them through business school, and she made a home for the other until she got married. Do the nieces come to see her? Oh, yes, now and then, out of a spirit of duty. But they dread these visits. They know they will have to sit and listen for hours to half-veiled reproaches. They will be treated to an endless litany of bitter complaints and self-pitying sighs. And when this woman can no longer bludgeon, browbeat, or bully her nieces into coming to see her, she has one of her spells. She develops a heart attack. Is the heart attack real? Yes. The doctors say she has a nervous heart, suffers from palpitations. But the doctors also say they can do nothing for her. Her trouble is emotional. What this woman really wants is love and attention, but she calls it gratitude. And she will never get gratitude or love because she demands it. She thinks it's her due. And there are thousands of people like her, people who are ill from ingratitude, loneliness, and neglect. They long to be loved, but the only way in this world that they can ever hope to be loved is to stop asking for it and to start pouring out love without hope of return. Does that sound like sheer, impractical, visionary idealism? It isn't. It's just horse sense. It's a good way for you and me to find the happiness we long for. I know. I have seen it happen right in my own family. My own mother and father gave for the joy of helping others. We were poor, always overwhelmed with debts, yet poor as we were, my father and mother always managed to send money every year to an orphan's home, the Christian Home in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Mother and father never visited that home. Probably no one thanked them for their gifts, except by letter, but they were richly repaid, for they had the joy of helping little children, without wishing for or expecting any gratitude in return. After I left home, I would always send father and mother a check at Christmas and urge them to indulge in a few luxuries for themselves, but they rarely did. When I came home a few days before Christmas, father would tell me of the coal and groceries they'd bought for some widow woman in town who had a lot of children and no money to buy food and fuel. What joy they got out of giving these gifts! The joy of giving without expecting anything whatever in return. I believe my father would almost have qualified for Aristotle's description of the ideal man, the man most worthy of being happy. The ideal man, said Aristotle, takes joy in doing favors for others. Now, here's the second point I'm trying to make in this chapter. If we want to find happiness, let's stop thinking about gratitude or ingratitude and give for the inner joy of giving. Parents have been tearing their hair about the ingratitude of children for 10,000 years. Even Shakespeare's King Lear cried out, "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child." But why should children be thankful, unless we train them to be? Ingratitude is natural, like weeds. Gratitude is like a rose. It has to be fed and watered and cultivated and loved and protected. If our children are ungrateful, who's to blame? Maybe we are. If we have never taught them to express gratitude to others, how can we expect them to be grateful to us? I knew a man in Chicago who had cause to complain of the ingratitude of his stepsons. He slaved in a box factory, seldom earning more than $40 a week. He married a widow, and she persuaded him to borrow money and send her two grown sons to college. Out of his salary of $40 a week, he had to pay for food, rent, fuel, clothes, and also for the payments on his note. He did this for 4 years, working like a coolie and never complaining. Did he get any thanks? No. His wife took it all for granted, and so did her sons. They never imagined that they owed their stepfather anything, not even thanks. Who was to blame? The boys? Yes, but the mother was even more to blame. She thought it was a shame to burden their young lives with a sense of obligation. She didn't want her sons to start out under debt, so she never dreamed of saying, "What a prince your stepfather is to help you through college." Instead, she took the attitude, "Oh, that's the least he can do." She thought she was sparing her sons, but in reality she was sending them out into life with the dangerous idea that the world owed them a living. And it was a dangerous idea, for one of those sons tried to borrow from an employer and ended up in jail. We must remember that our children are very much what we make them. For example, my mother's sister, Viola Alexander of Minneapolis, is a shining example of a woman who never had cause to complain about the ingratitude of children. When I was a boy, Aunt Viola took her own mother into her home to love and take care of, and she did the same thing for her husband's mother. I can still close my eyes and see those two old ladies sitting before the fire in Aunt Viola's farmhouse. Were they any trouble to Aunt Viola? Often, I suppose. But you never would have guessed it from her attitude. She loved those old ladies. She pampered them and spoiled them and made them feel at home. In addition, Aunt Viola had 6 children of her own, but it never occurred to her that she was doing anything especially noble or deserved any halos for taking those old ladies into her home. To her, it was the natural thing, the right thing, the thing she wanted to do. Now, where is Aunt Viola today? Well, she's now been a widow for 20-odd years, and she has 5 grown-up children, 5 separate households, all clamoring to share her and to have her come and live in their homes. Her children adore her. They never get enough of her. Out of gratitude? Nonsense. It is love, sheer love. Those children breathed in warmth and radiant human kindness all during their childhoods. Is it any wonder that now that the situation is reversed, they give back love? So let us remember that to raise grateful children, we have to be grateful. Let us remember little pitchers have big ears and watch what we say. To illustrate, the next time we're tempted to belittle someone's kindness in the presence of our children, let's stop. Let's never say, "Look at these dishcloths Cousin Sue sent for Christmas. She knit them herself. They didn't cost her a cent." The remark may seem trivial to us, but the children are listening. So instead, we'd better say, "Look at the hours Cousin Sue spent making these for Christmas. Isn't she nice? Let's write her a thank you note right now." And our children may unconsciously absorb the habit of praise and appreciation. To avoid resentment and worry over ingratitude, here is Rule 3. A. Instead of worrying about ingratitude, let's expect it. Let's remember that Jesus healed 10 lepers in one day, and only one thanked him. Why should we expect more gratitude than Jesus got? B. Let's remember that the only way to find happiness is not to expect gratitude, but to give for the joy of giving. C. Let's remember that gratitude is a cultivated trait. So if we want our children to be grateful, we must train them to be grateful. Chapter 15. Would you take $1 million for what you have? I have known Harold Abbott for years. He lived in Webb City, Missouri. He used to be my lecture manager. One day he and I met in Kansas City, and he drove me down to my farm in Belton, Missouri. During that drive, I asked him how he kept from worrying, and he told me an inspiring story I shall never forget. "I used to worry a lot," he said. "But one spring day, 1934, I was walking down West Doherty Street in Webb City. I saw a sight that banished all my worries. It happened in 10 seconds. But during those 10 seconds, I learned more about how to live than I had learned in the previous 10 years. For 2 years I'd been running a grocery store in Webb City," Harold Abbott said, as he told me the story. "I had not only lost all my savings, but I had incurred debts that took me 7 years to pay back. My grocery store had been closed the previous Saturday, and now I was going to the Merchants and Miners Bank to borrow money so I could go to Kansas City to look for a job. I walked like a beaten man. I'd lost all my fight and faith. Then suddenly, coming down the street, I saw a man who had no legs. He was sitting on a little wooden platform equipped with wheels from roller skates. He propelled himself along the street with a block of wood in each hand. I met him just after he crossed the street and was starting to lift himself up a few inches over the curb to the sidewalk. As he tilted his little wooden platform to an angle, his eyes met mine. He greeted me with a grand smile. 'Morning, sir. It's a fine morning, isn't it?' he said with spirit. As I stood looking at him, I realized how rich I was. I had 2 legs. I could walk. I felt ashamed of my self-pity. I said to myself, 'If he can be happy, cheerful, and confident without legs, I certainly can with legs.' I could already feel my chest lifting. I had intended to ask the Merchants and Miners Bank for only $100, but now I had courage to ask for $200. I had intended to say that I wanted to go to Kansas City to try to get a job, but now I announced confidently that I wanted to go to Kansas City to get a job. I got the loan, and I got the job. I now have the following words pasted on my bathroom mirror, and I read them every morning as I shave. I had the blues because I had no shoes, until upon the street I met a man who had no feet." I once asked Eddie Rickenbacker what was the biggest lesson he had learned from drifting about with his companions in life rafts for 21 days, hopelessly lost in the Pacific. "The biggest lesson I learned from that experience," he said, "was that if you have all the fresh water you want to drink and all the food you want to eat, you ought never to complain about anything." Time ran an article about a sergeant who had been wounded on Guadalcanal. Hit in the throat by a shell fragment, this sergeant had 7 blood transfusions. Writing a note to his doctor, he asked, "Will I live?" The doctor replied, "Yes." He wrote another note asking, "Will I be able to talk?" Again, the answer was yes. Then he wrote another note saying, "Then what in the hell am I worrying about?" Why don't you stop right now and ask yourself, "What in the hell am I worrying about?" You will probably find that it is comparatively unimportant and insignificant. About 90% of the things in our lives are right, and about 10% are wrong. If we want to be happy, all we have to do is concentrate on the 90% that are right and ignore the 10% that are wrong. If we want to be worried and bitter and have stomach ulcers, all we have to do is concentrate on the 10% that are wrong and ignore the 90% that are glorious. The words think and thank are inscribed in many of the Cromwellian churches of England. These words ought to be inscribed in our hearts, too. Think and thank. Think of all we have to be grateful for, and thank God for all our boons and bounties. Jonathan Swift, author of Gulliver's Travels, was the most devastating pessimist in English literature. He was so sorry that he had been born that he wore black and fasted on his birthdays. Yet in his despair, this supreme pessimist of English literature praised the great health-giving powers of cheerfulness and happiness. The best doctors in the world, he declared, are Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet,